When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Follow the Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to our episodes early and ad-free and get access to monthly exclusive episodes. Go to patreon.com/madnesspod. You can also hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts for ad-free episodes. We've got links in our show notes.
The opinions expressed in the following episode do not necessarily reflect those of the Minds of Madness podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
There's a peculiar kind of comfort that comes when someone tells us exactly what we've been hoping to hear. Maybe it's a politician promising to fix everything we think is broken, or a doctor offering one clean diagnosis that suddenly makes everything make sense. In the world of unsolved crimes, there's nothing more satisfying than a full confession, especially one that ties up every loose end with a clean, final answer. When a confession fills in the blanks, it gives us a sense of relief we call closure, because at last, the story feels complete. But there's a difference between feeling complete and being complete. On February 22, 2017, detectives with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation sat across a 33-year-old man in a small-town police station. They listened as he described exactly what had happened to a missing woman who'd vanished without a trace 11 years earlier. His confession seemed to solve what had become the state's most infamous cold case. It was exactly what authorities had waited more than a decade for. But of course, there's danger in hearing exactly what you want to hear. Because once a story sounds right, once it feels like closure, we tend to stop asking questions. And in this case, that may be exactly what had happened. Join me now as we examine the infamous cold case of Tara Grinstead, a beloved school teacher who disappeared in 2005. We'll take a look inside the largest police file in Georgia history, a mystery that gripped a community for over a decade. And we'll unravel the 2017 confession from two former classmates, a twist that still splits their town down the middle. On Saturday, October 22, 2005, 30-year-old Tara Grinstead had a full day ahead in the small town of Ocilla, Georgia. That morning, she welcomed a handful of young women into her home, helping them to get ready for the Miss Georgia Sweet Potato Pageant. It was a long-standing tradition, and Tara took pride in mentoring contestants, helping them with their hair, makeup, and stage presence. Dana Giddens was one of the contestants Tara helped that day.
I knew Tara through the pageant world. I was 16. She was the director of the Miss Red and Black pageant. And at my freshman year, she was the director. And after that pageant, she took me under her wing and she started coaching me for pageantry, doing my hair and makeup for pageants, homecoming, prom, anything that I needed like that. That morning, we had all of the girls had interviews. And then after the interviews, we came back and we would get our hair and makeup done by Tara. And then after that, we would go and get on stage and they would judge us based on our beauty.
Pageants were Tara's passion, especially cheering on the young women she mentored.
She actually sat with my parents at the pageant. After the pageant was over, I just escorted her out to her car.
After the pageant, Tara went to a friend's house for a neighborhood cookout. After a few hours of socializing, Tara drove home around 11 p.m., and that was the last time anyone saw her. The next day, Sunday, October 23rd, Tara's mother, Faye, tried calling her daughter several times. But as hours passed with no response, her worry deepened. She eventually reached out to a police captain from nearby Perry, Georgia, a man named Heath Dykes, who she knew was close to Tara.
We grew up together in the same town, Hawkinsville. She's 4.5 years younger than I am.
Heath and Tara had been secretly seeing each other for about 8 months. It was a secret because Heath was married at the time. Heath had spoken to Tara on the phone Saturday evening after the pageant.
I said if I could work it out, I would try to see her Sunday. She was kind of down, kind of sad. I tried to talk to her and cheer her up, be funny with her. And basically we hung up the phone. About 5 or 6 seconds later after we hung up, I called her right back and she answered the phone and she seemed to be in a better mood.
They agreed to talk again the next day.
I got up Sunday morning. Actually, I went deer hunting with a couple of friends, got back to the house. My kids had a fall festival at their school and we went to the Centerville Elementary School where we went to fall festival. After we left there, we grabbed something to eat, I think at Larry's Subs. From there, I was in contact with a guy I was supposed to go deer hunting with that afternoon and told him that I was going to be hunting in Hawkinsville that afternoon. And I left a message on our house phone.
That Sunday, Heath called Tara multiple times, but she never picked up. By the time Faye reached out that evening, Heath was already starting to worry too.
It was late into the evening, she called. I decided to go down to Tara's house to see if I could find her because I was worried about something was wrong. I just knew it wasn't like her character to not respond, not answer.
By then, it had been nearly 24 hours since Tara was last seen leaving the cookout.
I pulled up in the driveway and it was late, probably around 12 a.m. I went to the front door. Knocked on the door several times. She had a dog named Dolly. It was barking. I walked around to the fence and patted it, calmed down. And I walked back over to the carport where a car was, and I put my hand on top of the car to see if it was warm, and it was cold. I tapped on the window up there trying to see if, put my knuckles and hit the window to see if, somebody would hear me. And I just banged on it, trying to get somebody to come to the door. And I called Miss Faye. At that point, I called Miss Faye after exhausting all attempts to try to, make contact with her. And I asked her what she wanted me to do. She had a neighbor by the name of, she called him Mr. Joe. Anyway, I asked Miss Faye at that point, "Does you want me to go over to Mr. Joe's house and see if he knows anything, if he's heard from her?" And she told me no, it was too late, that she would contact Mr. Joe in the morning and have her check on Tara.
On Monday, October 24th, Tara didn't show up for work at Irwin County High School, where she taught history. School officials soon contacted police and reported her missing. Using a spare key from a neighbor, police unlocked Tara's front door and went inside. But Tara was nowhere to be found. There were no signs of a forced entry, no indication of a struggle. Tara's phone was still charging on her nightstand. The clothes she'd worn Saturday night were piled on the floor, but her purse and keys were gone. Police then asked Tara's best friend to walk them through the house to see if anything else seemed out of place.
She is my best friend. We've known each other forever, but since we were born, but 14, 15 years, we were best friends.
This is Maria Woods, a fellow teacher who'd been inside Tara's house many times before.
I mean, there were a few things that were off to me, but considering what she was doing, and I knew she was doing Saturday, I mean, it looked pretty normal. You could tell with some, she had jewelry out placed where they could pick it out, and you could tell she'd gone through some of her stuff, you know, maybe to share with them or show them things.
But Maria did notice two things missing.
Well, the only things that I could find were some shoes that she and I both had a pair of. They're like New Balance tennis shoes, but half of the part was tennis shoes. And then you slid your foot in them. They're just very odd shoes. And she got them, and I thought they were ugly at first. And then I decided I wanted some. So she and I had the same pair. That's why they'd stick out to me. I couldn't find those. And I noticed the week before that, she was keeping them behind the door. And then she had just a regular pair of black yoga pants that she wore in bed, out of bed, you know, just wherever, and we couldn't find those.
After searching the home, investigators turned their attention to the front yard. There, lying about 15 feet from the door, they found a white latex glove. It was collected as evidence and sent to a state crime lab for testing. They had no way of knowing it at the time, but for the next 17 years, that single glove would become the most important and most controversial piece of evidence in the entire case. By 30, Tara Grinstead had already become a fixture in her small community, a respected history teacher loved by her students. Outside the classroom, she was known for the pageant world. Crowned Miss Tifton in 1999 and a contender for Miss Georgia. Recently, she applied to study for a PhD. She coached cheerleading, mentored local girls, and showed up at every community event. In a town the size of Osceola, just about everyone knew Tara, if not personally, then by reputation. So when she was reported missing, it sent shockwaves through the town. Sensing this was more than a routine call, Osceola police reached out to the Georgia Bureau of Investigation.
Murder was a possibility. Her leaving on her own was a possibility. A kidnapping in which she was still alive somewhere was a possibility.
This is Gary Rothwell, the special agent in charge of Tara's case with the GBI. While searching Tara's home, the GBI discovered about 30 missed calls on her answering machine and caller ID. Most were from family and friends, but one call stood out.
The caller ID on Tara's home phone, her landline phone, which showed at approximately 9:26 a.m. on Sunday, October 23rd, there was a call from North Coast Pay with a local number. That local number, and found it to be a payphone a few blocks from Tara's house. And we saw something interesting. Basically, it was a Altel directory assistance number, which showed us that this payphone, someone had used the payphone and had called essentially 411 Connect to try to get Tara's telephone number and then telephone her residence.
The timing was strange. Someone who didn't know her number tried calling her before anyone realized she was missing. Was it a clue or just a red herring? Investigators turned their attention to Tara's personal life.
So the first thing that you do are look at people that have close relationships with that person, romantic relationships particularly. So there were several persons that we had to pursue immediately to try to
establish their alibis and their relationships with Tara and see if we could develop with any evidence to support or refute any involvement in her disappearance.
Investigators examined several men connected to Tara. There was Heath Dykes, the married police captain. There was a recent ex-boyfriend. And then there'd been a former student who'd been arrested outside Tara's home just months before she vanished. At the time of that incident, Heath Dykes was inside Tara's house.
Somebody started banging on the door. Well, she looked out the window first to see who it was, and she said, "Oh my God." And I said, "What is it?" And she said, "It's that crazy Anthony." Didn't have a clue who it was. He was screaming, "Please talk to me, please talk to me, please come outside and talk to me." And he was like in a panic, like something, some emergency or something. Well, I came to the door, and he started, seeing my presence seemed to agitate him. And he started, you know, using profane language towards me and cussing. And Tara said, "Just go back in. It's not, you know, not going to help anything." And I saw the local law enforcement pull up. I don't know who called him. Somebody called him. He was arrested, and they left. Yeah, I was curious what all that was about.
Tara's personal life sparked a storm of gossip, much unfounded and even scandalous. But investigators remained focused, methodically vetting each man connected to Tara. And then came a breakthrough. Forensics confirmed that Tara's DNA was on the white latex glove found in her yard. There was also DNA found from an unknown male.
Now, what the game changer was the fact that it had her DNA on the glove, not that it had unidentified DNA, because that could have been left by someone just dropping a glove or leaving it. But the fact that her DNA was on that glove meant that that glove was used to come in contact with her in some fashion.
Investigators began running comparisons, checking the unknown DNA against any potential suspects. But one by one, they were all ruled out. Despite the efforts, every lead hit a dead end. Tara's case began to grow cold, but media interest was only heating up.
Tara's case was, I think it was the first case after the Natalie Holloway disappearance of the Alabama young lady that disappeared in Aruba. And that was kind of the advent of the 24-hour cable news coverage of missing young women that we've seen so much of. I can remember when we first started getting some coverage, and I looked at my agents and I said, "Boys," and I said, "Don't worry about it. Osula ain't Aruba." And what I meant by that was that I didn't think all these reporters would come all the way down to South Georgia to cover this the way they did Natalie Holloway, and I was wrong. And it was something that we were not expecting, and we had a lot of difficulty handling it.
The flood of attention brought both pressure and chaos.
When a case goes national, people from all over provide information, and much of it is extraneous information. However, you have to address every lead, or try to at least address every lead after you prioritize them. And it's a tremendous strain on resources, both in handling the investigation itself and in sorting out the information as to what's important and what's not, what's handled and what is not handled, and that sort of thing. When a case gets this kind of publicity, you have a lot of self-deployment by law enforcement agencies. You have people that are volunteering. You have civilian participation. It becomes an entity into itself, and that information was not necessarily coming to us in a coherent manner. In this instance, we had tip lines, websites, what have you, where information was coming into people that were not involved in the investigation. I believe it was the largest case file in GBI history, and it was dozens of GBI agents participated and countless others from other agencies.
Years passed, and Tara's case remained unsolved. But what no one realized was that the answer was hiding in plain sight all along, buried in police records, almost from the very beginning. In November 2005, just weeks after Tara's disappearance, a man named Garen Lott came forward with a disturbing story. He said he'd been at a bonfire with old high school friends, out in a pecan orchard about 10 minutes outside of Osceola. That night, the conversation turned to Tara. Two of Garland's friends, 21-year-olds Bo Dukes and Ryan Duke, both former students at Tara's school, made comments that stuck with them.
There was a comment made at a party that I attended to at the pecan orchard in Fitzgerald. There was parked vehicles around, there was a fire, and we were standing around. I'm not exactly sure, but best of my knowledge, I believe they were standing outside of the vehicle. The statement that I recall was, we killed and burned everybody, basically.
Despite the similarities in their last names, Bo Dukes and Ryan Duke are not related. Garland reported what he'd heard to his employer, who then passed the information along to police.
I was never interviewed by law enforcement. I just assumed that I took the best steps at the time, and it was just a statement possibly made by some drunk young people, and it just wasn't really anything. It turned out to be nothing.
But for reasons that remain unclear, Garland's tip was either overlooked, ignored, or quietly dismissed. But his tip wasn't the only time that Bo and Ryan's names had come up. 1 year after Tara's disappearance in December 2006, Bo Dukes was attending basic training for the U.S. Army. Over the Christmas and New Year's holidays, recruits were given a two-week break to go home. Bo invited a fellow recruit, John McCullough, to spend the holidays with him in Georgia.
We had gone out several times to just minor little small places around town and, you know, just to hang out, you know, nothing too crazy.
While driving through town one night, John noticed a billboard with a face and a haunting message. Tara Grinstead, missing.
I had mentioned something about seeing a billboard, and it had a really, really pretty lady that was on it. And I was like, man, that's crazy. You know, what's going on with that?
A few days later, Bo answered John's question.
Well, it was pretty late at night, and he had been drinking and also used some substances, cocaine. And I was driving. We had stopped at a convenience store, parked in the parking lot. And, you know, we're just sitting there. You know, seemed like something was bothering him, possibly. And he was like, well, man, he was like, you know, I need to tell you something. Do you remember that billboard that you had seen? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, I know what happened.
What Bo said next would stay with John for the rest of his life.
I know what happened. I was there, and he said that his friend had showed up and said, man, I f***ed up. He needed his help. He needed his truck. He had said that he had killed Tara, beat her, and accidentally strangled her and killed her, and he didn't know what to do. So he needed his truck to be able to move her body. He said that he had went with his friend and used the truck. He had said that they had went and recovered the body, and they continued to take it to the middle of his grandpa's pecan orchard. And the exact location didn't tell me, but had made the comment of, you know, we took her to the middle of the pecan orchard and burned her body.
Deeply disturbed, John contacted police a few weeks later.
And I just told them, hi, my name's John McCullough. I have some information about the missing school teacher. Provided my phone number, and then in which they had said, we can get somebody to contact you back.
But no one ever did. Over the years, John tried again and again to reach someone in law enforcement.
I tried calling the GBI several times. I had reached out to other police departments that were in the vicinity, like Osceola and then Rochelle. Never got called back, took it almost as a joke. One had actually made a comment of, we get tips from people all the time like this, so we'll make a note of it. If anything comes from it, we'll give you a call back. I just wanted to call and try and do my part, and I figured, man, I'm reaching out to all these people, and they don't want to believe me. Even with my wife, you know, I've told her several times, what else can I do? What can I do?
It took nearly 9 years before John McCullough was finally interviewed by GBI in June of 2016. By that time, Agent Jason Shawdell had taken over as a lead investigator, and the case was being re-examined. After hearing John's story, the GBI reached out to Beau Dukes, but Beau denied everything. He claimed he'd never made those statements to John and said he knew nothing about Tara's disappearance. His DNA was collected and tested against the latex glove found at the crime scene, but the results were inconclusive.
He had told me later that day that they were going around and swabbing everybody.
This is Brooke Sheridan, Beau's girlfriend at the time. After Beau's interview with the GBI, Brooke noticed a dramatic shift in his behavior.
He was starting to have severe anxiety attacks, panic attacks. He kept to himself a lot. He had suicidal ideations.
6 months later, on January 10th, 2017, Beau suffered a full-blown panic attack.
After I got him calm, I told him that he needed to tell me what was going on, and he proceeded to tell me what had happened. He told me that his roommate had gone into her home, had strangled her, and that he had taken his truck and put her body, and that he helped to destroy the body.
That roommate, according to Beau, was Ryan Duke.
They were friends in high school, best friends in high school. They were always together, they were very close, and they had become roommates.
When Brooke pressed Beau for more details, he told her everything he remembered about that weekend back in 2005.
He said that the following Sunday morning that Ryan had come home and he had woken Beau up, and Ryan said, "I killed Tara Grinstead." They had been drinking the night before. He thought he was kidding. He went back to sleep.
But 3 days later, on Wednesday, Beau would learn that Ryan had a serious issue.
Ryan said, "You know, I need to show you something," and then they took Beau's truck out to the orchard. He said that Tara's body was laying there on her back. There was discoloration, blue, like bluish marks around her neck, strangulation marks. They moved her body down a path into a wooded area. They went to a woodshed that had pecan wood, and they brought the wood back to burn the body. He didn't think that there was anything left from what he had said.
A few weeks later, Brooke contacted the police and told them what Beau had confessed. And on February 21st, 2017, Beau Dukes gave a full confession to the GBI. According to Beau, Ryan had broken into Tara's house using a credit card and strangled her while she lay in bed. The following day, February 22nd, the GBI brought in Ryan Duke for questioning. Almost immediately, he confessed to murdering Tara.
"I used to break into people's houses just to steal money. I was a drug addict. I've been drinking. I was high. I don't remember everything clearly.
Okay.
But I was stealing from her purse, and she snuck up on me, and I hit her. I didn't mean to. It's really reactionary, but... and I ran. I didn't know what else to do. I can't lie. I can't live with myself. I'm so sick of this. I'm tired. And my family's good people. I didn't want to do this to them."
It was the moment investigators had waited nearly 12 years for. To make sure Ryan was telling the truth, Agent Shawdell tested whether he could provide guilty knowledge, specific details only the real killer would know.
Guilty knowledge is the facts of an investigation that the only people who know of that would be the person or persons who committed the actual act because they were there at the time. The first one was on the glove. We never disclosed early on was that Tara's DNA was on the gloves. The second is a telephone call that was made to Tara's house that Sunday morning. He said he brought the gloves after he killed her. He said he killed her, then left the house in a rush, went back to his house to gather a quilt and the gloves to then come back to the crime scene, which is, again, when he made the phone call on his way back to the house and then went to the house.
Agents also checked to see if Ryan would match Bo's earlier statement about using a credit card to break into Tara's home.
He went in the very first 5 minutes of the interview, I asked him, how did you get in the house? And he says, I used a credit card. It was very easy. I used a credit card.
Following his confession, Ryan Duke was arrested and charged with murder. 10 days later, Bo Dukes was also arrested for his role in the crime. Forensic teams were sent to the pecan orchard. There, they recovered fragments of human bone believed to be Tara's. But the remains were too damaged for a conclusive DNA match. Then came the final, most definitive breakthrough. Ryan's DNA was tested against the unknown male profile on the white latex glove. It was a perfect match. After more than a decade of heartache, frustration, and unanswered questions, Tara's case finally seemed solved. But within weeks of his arrest, Ryan changed his story. He now claimed his confession was false. He pleaded not guilty and said it was Bo who actually killed Tara. Bo Dukes stood trial in March 2019. He wasn't charged with Tara's murder, but with lying to the GBI and helping to cover up a crime. The jury found him guilty, and he was sentenced to 25 years in prison. When Ryan Duke went on trial 3 years later in May 2022, the state presented the same theory of the case.
Ryan Duke, the man in that chair, confessed to the murder of Tara Grinson. He confessed with the words of his own mouth, the words expressed from his own thoughts. He convicts himself by his own words. The defendant admits in his statement that he murdered her, that he killed her, and he left. I struck her, I hit her with my hand. Tells you his motive was, I'm a drug addict, and I need money to buy drugs, and I break in people's houses, and I steal $20.
The prosecution leaned heavily on Ryan's original confession, but his defense team argued it wasn't the truth. Ryan took the stand in his own defense and gave the jury a very different version of events. According to him, he spent the night of Saturday, October 22nd, drinking in his trailer with Bo.
I just remember us taking tequila shots, and the next day I know I'm out.
Do you know approximately what time that night that you passed out?
It'd been 9, 10 o'clock.
Where did you pass out at, if you remember?
In the bathroom, hugging the toilet.
Ryan's aunt and uncle confirmed it. They'd found him passed out cold, and later told Bo to leave their property.
Do you have a clear memory of waking up that morning?
I was woke up. Bo woke me up. I was still in the bathroom. I was asleep on the floor. He looked panicked, freaked out. You know, he was pale. He was upset, shaking almost, just, you know, tell something was wrong.
That's when Bo told Ryan he'd killed Tara. At first, Ryan didn't believe him, until he saw Tara's purse and wallet sitting on a table. He thought maybe Bo had just stolen them.
Was going to try to return her purse, so I went to the bedroom, asked Bo if I could borrow the keys. He didn't answer me, so I grabbed his keys and got in the truck.
Ryan knew where Tara lived roughly, but not her exact address, so he called 411 for help and dialed her house from a payphone. When she didn't answer, he drove back to the trailer. That's when Bo took him out to the pecan orchard.
I'm getting more and more worried. I can tell something's wrong, but I still think Bo's screwing with me. You know, he did that a lot. He turned into the orchard. We drive down the trail. He goes all the way to the end of the trail, to the back of the orchard. I still think he's screwing with me. You know, I think this is a joke. He walks around the front of the truck into the clearing, and I take a couple steps towards him, and that's when I see part of her. I just remember seeing a spot of white. It's kind of covered up, leaves and limbs and, you know, covered up. Like I said, I just seen something that didn't belong there. They were laying face down. I stopped at the clearing. I froze where I was. He reaches down. He grabs her arm and just flips her over. He looks at me and says, "I told you."
According to Ryan, Bo then loaded wood into the truck bed.
When Bo starts to unload the wood, he told me to get out and help him. He lit her on fire. He takes me back to the trailer. He tells me, "You can't say anything, you can't talk about this."
Ryan testified that he stayed quiet because he was scared. He believed Bo would kill again.
When did you decide that you were going to take the blame for Ms. Grinstead's death?
Sometime before I left home.
So it was that same day
that you gave the statement? Yes, sir, that morning.
Why did you decide that you were going to take the blame for Ms. Grinstead's death?
Because I don't think Bo will ever tell the truth.
When you spoke to Agent Shaldell, did you know, or do you know today, how Ms. Grinstead actually died?
I do not.
At some point after you confessed to Agent Shaldell, did you change your mind about taking the blame for Ms. Grinstead's death?
Yes, sir.
When did you change your mind about that?
I had a visit scheduled with my dad.
Why did you change your mind?
I couldn't lie to my father.
The defense attacked the two central pillars of the state's case, Ryan's confession and the white latex glove. First, they claimed that most of the details in Ryan's confession were actually introduced by the agent who conducted the interview.
As soon as Ryan Duke walked into that interview room, they had an answer and they were going to close this case. They were anxious for closure of this case and they were blinded by it. And they refused to look at the details. Agent Shaddell told you that when Ryan gave the statement, that's it. He didn't go and look into the case file to see if it was actually consistent with case evidence. And the information that Ryan gave in the interview was fed to him by Agent Shaddell. It was all over the place. Why was it all over the place? Because he wasn't there. He has no idea what the facts are surrounding her death because he was not there.
A close review of the interview transcript backed that up. The date, time, and location of the murder were all first suggested by the agent.
And at that point, he had not said he went to her home.
Not at that point, no.
You then asked him again. You went to her house. He still hadn't told you he went to her house.
Not at that point yet, no.
Okay. And then about 20 seconds later, you asked a third time, how did you get into her house? He still hadn't told you he went to her house. And you said you assumed it was late Saturday, early Sunday. You brought that up first.
Correct.
Even the detail about the credit card came from the agent, not Ryan.
He actually did not say he used a credit card. You said he used a credit card. He never mentioned a credit card first.
I asked him how he got in the house. That was one of the qualifier questions that I asked him at that first onset. How did he get into the house? And he said it was pretty easy. I picked the lock. And I think I said with a card. So, yes, I introduced the car.
And the state's strongest piece of evidence, the latex glove, was also first mentioned by the agent.
So let's talk about the glove. You initially told Ryan at about 13 minutes in, tell me about the gloves. I know there were some gloves. At that point, Ryan had never mentioned the glove, correct?
Correct.
You told him there were gloves.
Correct.
He told you he never put them on.
Correct.
All of it, the defense argued, was a textbook example of how false confessions are created. And then, there was the lock.
How did Ryan supposedly get in the house with a credit card? Let's think about that for a second. There was a second lock on the door. That interior lock is an important key fact in this case. Can't be picked. Can't use a credit card to pick that lock. It's a hotel-style lock. It goes over like this and it locks. And it from the inside, and you couldn't use a credit card to get in.
On the inside of Tara's door, a hotel-style lock had been installed. The kind with a metal latch that hooks over a nub attached to the door frame. Once secured, it can't be opened from the outside. Not with a credit card. Not even with a key.
That lock is important because we learned that Tara Grinstead's greatest fear was being attacked at night. Her best friend came here and told you she's known Tara Grinstead since she's 4 years old. She saw her regularly. Been inside that house regularly. And what did she tell you? She told you Tara would have locked that door if she'd been there that night. We know on Monday morning that door was locked from the outside. He turns the key and opens it. That tells us that interior lock was never locked that night. That means Tara Grinstead was never inside that house, and that was not a crime scene. She left that house and locked the door behind her, took her purse and keys, and we don't know where she went. But we know she wasn't there.
But on Monday morning, that latch was not engaged. According to the defense, that meant one thing. Tara hadn't been inside the house Saturday night. She left, locked up behind her, and whatever happened, happened somewhere else. And it wasn't the only clue. Tara's shoes and yoga pants were missing, suggesting she may have left voluntarily. Several neighbors testified they hadn't seen her car on Sunday morning, but did see it later that afternoon. When investigators examined it on Monday, it was unlocked, and the driver's side seat had been pushed far back, like someone taller had been behind the wheel. Each detail on its own might seem small, but taken together, the defense argued, they didn't just cast doubt, they unraveled the state's entire theory. Then, they turned to the glove.
So let's talk more about the glove. This is the state's smoking gun, right? The glove. Well, what do we know about that glove? We know the state hasn't brought a single witness to tell you that it was on the ground before Monday morning. They don't have a single person that came in here and told you that that glove was on the ground before Monday morning. We brought you some folks to tell you that on Sunday, they didn't see it.
The defense pointed to three witnesses who'd been to Tara's home before the police arrived. None of them saw the glove in the yard, including Heath Dykes.
He's a captain in the police department. He lives an hour and 20 minutes away. He's so concerned, he drives all the way to Osceola to check on her. When he gets here, he's in, be fair to classify it, as panic mode. He's trained in scene investigations. And what did he tell you he saw at midnight on Sunday? Did he not see a glove? He was looking for things that might be out of the ordinary to figure out what was going on. He's searching the outside of the house. He's looking in windows. He's walking around. He sat here and he told you, he said, I didn't see a glove, and I would have seen a glove if it was there. That was his testimony. What's the only conclusion you could draw from that? That glove was not on the ground.
The defense even suggested Beau Dukes could have planted the glove himself. But beyond the physical evidence, they challenged the very logic of the state's timeline.
Under the state's theory, Brian drove back to that house in broad daylight on Sunday at church time, took a quilt, put Miss Grinstead in the quilt, carried her out the front door, put her in the truck, then went back to lock the front door, because we know the door was locked, right? So he had to go back after doing this and risk being seen at 9:30 in the morning to lock the front door. Does that make common sense? Why would he do that? What's the reason to lock the front door? Wouldn't he just get in the truck and go?
And the final blow to that theory? Not a single neighbor, not one, reported seeing a pickup truck at Tara's house that morning. After nearly 2 weeks of testimony, the case was handed over to the jury.
The state of Georgia versus Ryan Alexander Duke, we the jury find the defendant count one, malice murder, not guilty. Count two, felony murder, not guilty. Count three, felony murder, not guilty. Count four, aggravated assault, not guilty. Count five, burglary, not guilty. Count six, concealing death of another, guilty.
For concealing Tara Grinstead's death, Ryan Duke was sentenced to 10 years in prison, the maximum sentence allowed under Georgia law. But because he'd already spent 5 years awaiting trial, he'd technically completed half of that sentence, which means Ryan will be eligible for release in 2027. The verdict in Ryan Duke's trial sent shockwaves through the community, but it also raised a troubling question, one the legal system may never fully answer. Two men admitted to helping cover up the murder of Tara Grinstead, and yet, neither has been actually convicted of her murder. The state of Georgia has given no indication that Beau Dukes will ever face murder charges. And in recent years, Even more disturbing details have come to light. In 2023, Bo pleaded guilty to charges in two separate cases from 2017 and 2019, where he was accused of sexually assaulting women at gunpoint. For these offenses, he received another 10-year sentence to be served concurrently with his existing 25-year sentence. In the end, all the legal twists, courtroom drama, and media frenzy have often obscured the most important truth. This story is about Tara Grinstead, a vibrant woman whose life was cut tragically short. Tara was a dedicated teacher, deeply loved by her students, a mentor to young women, a scholar with dreams of earning her doctorate, becoming a school principal, and starting a family. Today, Tara would have been 50 years old. If her life hadn't been stolen, she might have had children of her own. Maybe even teaching at the very same high school where she once inspired so many. The trials of Bo Dukes and Ryan Duke left behind more questions than answers. And for Tara's family, that means the painful wait for true resolution continues. For 17 years, they lived with a revolving cycle of uncertainty. First, wondering where Tara had gone. Then, what happened to her? And finally, who was truly responsible? During Ryan's sentencing, Tara's stepmother Connie delivered a statement. Her words captured the heartbreak of a family that's endured the unimaginable.
October 2005 was one of the most painful journeys that I think any family could ever be faced with. There are words that are seared in our memories forever. Missing, disappeared, vanished, and murdered. For over 11 years, we went to bed every night wondering where Tara was, and we woke up every morning with the same question, where is she? We wondered if she was dead or alive. Tara lost her life, and that left a hole in our hearts that can never be filled. We will feel the pain of this loss for as long as we live. We are still left with painful questions. Did she know she was going to die? Did she beg for her life? Did she suffer? I don't think mere words will ever be adequate to truly express the deep sorrow and grief that we have endured.
But amid Connie's obvious sorrow, she also spoke of Tara's legacy, not just as a beloved teacher, but as a guiding light that still reaches others, even in death.
She encouraged her students to reach their full potential. She didn't just want them to do well in her class. She wanted them to do well in life. She was a teacher in life, and we believe she is still a teacher in death. We hope others will realize the consequences of choosing a life of alcohol and drugs, the consequences of murdering someone and burning their body, and the consequences of devastating the lives of those that she left behind. For anyone who has chosen that life or is even being tempted, we plead with you not to take that path. No good will ever come out of that for them or anybody that loves them.
Follow the Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. To support the show and get access to ad-free episodes, extra content, and Patreon-exclusive episodes, go to patreon.com/madnesspod. To find us on Instagram and Facebook, search The Minds of Madness, and on Twitter using the handle @madnesspod. And also, by checking out our sponsors and using our promo codes, you're also helping support the show. We've got all the links in our episode notes. So until next week, thanks for listening.